This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 13th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 391. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the Big Deal feature, this week's guest is Tristan Hopper, who writes the first reading column daily in the National Post. He is also the author of a book that you need to read before you vote on April 28th. It is called Don't Be Canada, How One Country Did Everything Wrong All at Once. Tristan Hopper joins me from Victoria. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. My guest this week is Tristan Hopper, columnist with the National Post, who joins me from Victoria, BC. His column, First Reading, is vital reading every day, especially during this federal election campaign. And he's the author of the new book. It's called Don't Be Canada, How One Country Did Everything Wrong All at Once. It's published by Sutherland House. It's darkly comic, but it's an accurate snapshot of Canada in the 2020s. Here we are in the middle of the 2020s. And I'll quote from the book. It says how one of the richest, most tolerant, and most functional countries on Earth decided to take wealth, tolerance, and functionality for granted. It's about how the most educated nation on Earth was convinced to go all out on unproven theories without considering the consequences. So, Tristan, welcome to the podcast. When did you get the idea to write this book, and what was the moment that made you do it? The moment that you said, "This is the book in a nutshell. This is the thesis, and I got to do it."
I worked at the National Post since 2011, and one of the things I like to do is I'll just do regular sort of internet searches for how Canada is being mentioned in the international press. So I'll just search the word Canada, and you'll see, you know, in the Indian press, in the English press, in the European press, how Canada is being mentioned. And when I first started in 2011, we really only were mentioned either for something cutesy. It would be like, oh, you know, adorable goose like Snuggles. Or it would be if we were ever mentioned in the context of policy, it was usually how another country could be like Canada. So, you know, what's an ideal immigration system? Well, Canada is the most ideal immigration system. The points-based immigration system is beneficial for Canada. There's basically no sort of mainstream anti-immigrant movement in Canada because they've managed it so well. So there was a few areas in which, if you want to manage a debt crisis, you know, the absolute best way to manage a debt crisis is how Canada did it in the 1990s. It's sort of the model for how others should do it. There's actually an article going around right now. It's a New York Times article from 2014 mentioning how Canada had the world's richest middle class. So, you know, right in the sort of 2010s, you would have, I also remember from that era, you would have Canada was sort of held up as the so-called American dream was actually more the case here than it was in the United States. So just the idea of income mobility, if you worked hard, you could sort of, make a name for yourself. Just 10 or 15 years ago, the stats showed that that was easier to do in Canada than the United States. So around 10 years ago, and it's not a partisan book, so you're not going to find the name Trudeau in this book all that often. But about 10 years ago, and particularly in the last five, the way Canada was being mentioned internationally started to shift. We were frequently mentioned as a model of what not to do. And I'd never really seen that before. So I saw this in terms of euthanasia and medical assistance in dying. So you saw this when the UK was considering doing its own medical assistance in dying. This actually came up at committee. They said, well, whatever we do, if we do the Dutch system, if we do the Oregon system, we should really avoid what Canada has done. Canada has really screwed this up, gone way too far, overlooked a lot of problems with the system that we should best avoid. You also saw that in terms of drugs, harm reduction, you know, Canada climbed second only to Scotland, just in terms of the raw overdose rate. We were number one in sort of, we were actually at the bottom of the list for the OECD in terms of hospital beds. We've, of course, been number one for housing unaffordability for years at this point. So it was just sort of an amalgamation of seeing all these instances, just even mentioned in passing. There was actually the Financial Times had a story where it was mentioned the breakdown nations. So previously powerful and influential nations that sort of lost their global standing. And they said Canada is just the prime example of this. It's a Financial Times story. So it was just noticing that the way people perceive us, even the way people joke about us abroad. So 10, 15 years ago, you just, the standards, people who don't know much about Canada, maybe they'll have a joke about free healthcare. Maybe they'll have a joke about maple syrup. Now, the leading joke you're probably going to get is, are you really killing your elderly people? Or, you know, if you, the medical system is, if you got a cold, they're going to, I'm not doing these jokes justice. But it sort of started from that point, that very quickly Canada went from a nation that either nobody thought about, or we were seen as a place that was so well run, you didn't have to think about it, to on a number of levels, and not just drugs, not just euthanasia, not just affordability, a whole bunch of things all at once, we became the worst example in the entire world. So it was my surprise at that, which led to the book.
In the book, you describe crack pipe vending machines at hospitals, tampon dispensers at army bases, brochures at senior citizens care homes with a hotline to call for medical assistance in dying. Who or what is to blame for the Canada of today that all these trends have come together all at once? Who is to blame for this?
I tried to think of, I finished the book and I get to the end and I have to write a conclusion. And I'm trying to think of a grand unified theory as to how this hit harder. So you can call it woke politics, you can call it postmodernism or whatever. But it's these bad ideas that kind of exist all over the world. But Canada went in on them much harder than everybody else. And I was trying to figure out why that was. And my generalized sense, and there's a few reasons, but my generalized sense was, we were just very trusting and we got used to a country. Canada was so well run for so many years that we just got used to a country where that was going to exist forever. So I sort of cite in the conclusion, I think it was Gallup does rankings of public trust. And Canada was top of the list, even more than Europe. So you would usually assume Scandinavians just love their government and they trust their government. We ranked even higher than Scandinavia, even higher than Switzerland, in terms of the Canadian idea that our healthcare system is good. Our institutions know what they're doing. We can trust the court system. There is no politicization of our court system. These were all just sort of held up as maybe people in other countries have to worry about politicized courts or, you know, corruption within the civil service or idea or, you know, scientists ignoring inconvenient facts in the service of a narrative. Maybe this is something that happened in the other countries, but it doesn't happen in Canada. And I think because of that, ironically, it made us most vulnerable for that actually happening here. It's essentially, if you think of bad ideas as a disease, we didn't have any defenses for it. We had not been vaccinated for it. We didn't even think it was something that could ever happen to us. So for a lot of Canadians who are now buying this book, you think, oh, this is the best healthcare system in the world. Tommy Douglas is our greatest Canadian. I'm so grateful to be Canadian. And that only goes away when something happens to you and you're in an emergency room for 3 days and you're thinking, what the hell happened? This is the 180 degree difference from what I assumed was the case in Canada. So there's any number of things that I address in this book that people I know socially will just contact me and say, well, this can't be happening in Canada. This is Canada. We don't do things like this. They'll sign up for, they'll apply for a government job. And then there's a form where you have to fill out, you know, your different identities, you know, your racial identities, and you have to put your sexual orientation. And they're saying, this is outrageous that I have to fill this out. You know, this is Canada. You know, you can't do this. And I'll say, no, this is, there are quotas in place, identity-based quotas. This has been, federal policy going back several years at this point. Multiple universities and government agencies are now doing, you know, identity-based hiring quite explicitly. So this is the rule. And it's weird, there's a lot of things happening in Canada that are actually quite controversial in other countries, and they've happened here, and just no one's noticed. The classic example, I would say, transgender women in women's prisons. So these are people who are just, you know, male biologically, identify as women, and all you need is that self-ID form to transfer to a women's prison. So you essentially have someone who was convicted as a male sex offender, has had no surgery, hormones, or whatever, and just by signing a form is now legally a woman and can go to a women's prison. This was a big deal when a similar policy went through in Scotland. It actually indirectly led to the resignation of the Scottish First Minister. And when this was happening, I was thinking the exact same policy was put through in Canada. It's almost worse than Scotland, actually. It affected more inmates were able to transfer to women's prison. There are reports that there has been, you know, harassments and assaults of female inmates by these trans-identified inmates. And just no one notices. I would actually say most Canadians are probably not even aware that this is happening. So the book is just a number of those things where we are just convinced Canada is fine. We don't have to worry. There are things that would never happen here. And then when they start to happen, we don't even have our hackles raised that it's a possibility, ironically allowing it to go too far.
To your last chapter, which is called The World's Most Expensive Free Healthcare. The number of vice presidents at the health authorities, the government subsidiaries that run the hospitals, just outrageous. There's news this week in British Columbia, the NDP government announced that it will stop sending cancer patients across the border to clinics in Bellingham, Washington. It's been doing that for a few years just because of the backlog, not enough doctors, not enough hospital beds to treat people needing radiation treatments. So finally, the NDP government said this week that they're going to end the contracts in May. They say it's not anything to do with the Trump tariffs, just the fact that they say that they've hired more cancer doctors and have more space to do the treatments to keep people here in British Columbia in this system. And when I heard that, I said that Tommy Douglas can stop spinning in his grave, finally. Now, you call this one of the most brazen official admissions as to the superiority of the U.S. health system.
You've never had Canadian governments. Obviously, it's absolutely toxic for you to say we can't handle it here, so we have to send people to the American system. That's never happened before. And it only happened in BC just because it got so bad. You're like, well, we can either admit that there's a problem or people are going to die. Anything less than that, they probably wouldn't have done it.
The book has some fascinating chapters that really tell the story of how we've gotten to 2025 and the problems we have in Canada. Justin Trudeau was fond of saying diversity is strength, but in many ways there's not enough that binds us together. And what he did say recently on a CNN interview before he retired as prime minister and before Mark Carney took over, that one thing that defined Canadians was that we're not Americans, which I don't think that's good enough. We've got more to be proud of than just saying who we're not. But your chapters tell the story of euthanasia, identity politics, the high cost of housing, harm reduction, gender ideology, government censorship, catch and release justice system. How did you decide on weaving the story as you did in the chapter order?
Because there were areas in which there were elements in Canada, in which Canada was worst in the world. So there's a few areas in which we're pretty bad. But they didn't get their own chapter. So I was trying to find something in which, you know, maybe not on everything, but in which I could sort of make the argument that on this particular issue, Canada's either worse in the world or we've gone farther than anybody else in the world. And the harm reduction one, it was actually surprising to me. I always assumed no matter how sort of nuts we got on drug policy, there was always going to be some corner of Europe that had some nuttier version. So if we decriminalize drugs, there's got to be somewhere, you know, Portugal is got to be just, you know, handing out crack to school children. And just in the last, and that used to be the case. We had pretty liberalized medical marijuana, but you could always get recreational marijuana somewhere in Europe. But in the last 5 or 6 years, we are doing things here that Europe is not doing. They haven't leaned into safe consumption sites to nearly the same extent as we have. I mean, basically every mid-sized Canadian city or town has at least one safe consumption site. That's just not the case in Europe. You don't have safer supply. I mean, you have very small safer supply pilot projects where, you know, maybe under supervision, you can be given recreational opioids as part of sort of, you know, agonist treatments, et cetera. But BC, the program that they just suspended, where they just decided, oh, we'll just prescribe recreational opioids without basically any guardrails, except we would limit your, you know, and then we'll just ignore that people are flipping these to the black market. And no one has done anything like that. So it was each of these chapters in which, if I could point to something in which Canada was sort of an outlier on something. We had tried something no one else had done, and that was to our detriment. So it's almost a service we're doing to the world. I would, you know, non-Canadians should read this book, because we did a bunch of real dumb stuff that went off the rails immediately, and you should read it so that you don't do it yourself.
You do mention in the conclusion, you know, that headline, you know, also the economy sucks.
I didn't even get into the economy. I mean, that's sort of the number one issue that's coming up in this election, how we're, you know, the lowest in the OECD over the last 10 years for per capita GDP. We've seen sort of investment per worker drop off. I mean, there are any number of charts where you can just see blue, you know, right over, you know, starting 2014, 2015. And yeah, I didn't even have a chance to get into just the fact that over the last 2 years, we've seen, you know, hate rallies, anti-Israel hate rallies in our streets, unlike anything we've ever seen in our history. I think I mentioned that briefly in the introduction. So, I guess the theme of this is when you sort of, you know, abandon reality and just sort of lean into untested ideas, a lot can go wrong all at once, virtually everywhere.
I mean, this is a country with so much potential that it has changed the world in so many ways. Look at who we've produced. You know, Alexander Graham Bell, the telephone, Frederick Banting, insulin, James Naismith, basketball.
Everybody brings up those sort of names, but I just like food production. I mean, every day, most of the, you know, billions of people, I think I could actually argue billions. We are the world's leading exporter of just sort of lentils and peas. Of, you know, canola oil. A lot of people around the world, way more than there are Canadians, have a bit something that was produced in Canada in their belly. So there's any number of things in which we've been, you know, extraordinarily influential beyond just those big names that you mentioned. So yeah, the end result of this book, I've seen a lot of doomers saying, well, since Canada, yeah, I've never seen Canada like this, and there's no hope, and, you know, just get out while you can. I mean, even reading this book, which people have described as depressing, I tried to make it uplifting, is when you're looking at it, it's very much a portrait of a country that doesn't need to be this way. This is a country with extraordinary amounts of potential, good people, you know, generally good values, that has just lost its way and it compromised on all of those. So I would hope by the time you get to the conclusion, you can say this is a place that does not need to keep shooting itself in the foot. And my hope is that in 10 years, I can write a sequel in which it's, you know, be Canada. here's the ways you can take a country that's sort of has its head up its ass and, you know, can restore a sense of unity. You know, you can restore your economy. You can do all these kinds of things. So, yes, if there's an upside to this book, it's that these are insane problems, but they're all solvable problems.
In the conclusion, you say that if I can sum up over what went wrong with Canada over the past decade or so, it's that the country decided to run absolutely everything on the honor system and didn't have the imagination to consider why this would be a bad idea. How can we get out of this? What do you think needs to be done in Canada for us to turn this around?
Enough people have experienced what it's like to live like that. So, I mean, we mentioned... the first chapter is about medical assistance in dying. So what really stood out about that is when you look at medical assistance in dying systems, and there's not many, there's but a couple dozen around the world, all of them were really on the ball about imagining how it could go wrong. They're like, okay, well, we gotta protect for this. We gotta protect for hospitals that are just gonna wanna get patients out of the way. We gotta protect for rogue doctors who are just gonna start, you know, cruising the country. So we have to have controls. We have to imagine how a bad actor would exploit the system and design a system that is resilient to that. And Canada didn't do that at all. I mean, ours started with a Supreme Court decision, and you can actually read it. The line is quoted in the book where they said we shouldn't assume this isn't going to be well managed. So people were telling them at the time, if you make, assisted suicide without any expectation of terminal illness, a right under the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, that can very quickly go to places you didn't expect very quickly. And at the time, I mean, you could just read the media accounts at the time, no one assumed that would happen. Like, no, this is Canada. We can do it, and we're going to be different than the Dutch or the Americans or who else. It's that, running that on the honor system. You see that in how we sort of designed bail. It was just, I don't know. I maybe it took 10 years of just sort of walking through tent cities, you know, being assaulted on public transit, having your bike stolen, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Where I certainly have seen a movement of Canadians realizing that that maybe wasn't a particularly good idea. And we can still be progressive, we could still be tolerant, but you still have to control for jerks coming in and screwing things up. We can't just ask people not to be jerks.
Yeah, it's an important book at an important time. Here we are during the election campaign where Canadians are faced with choosing their future. And the way that election campaigns work, the campaigners always love to tell you that elections are about the future. However, of course, there is the school of thought, especially by Pierre Poilievre and the Conservatives, that they're trying to prosecute the Liberal record over the past decade. Your book really is something that Canadians really need to read before they go to the polls.
I didn't know there was an election coming. We thought we would have about 6 months for the election. So I wrote it. It's accessible to an international market because I wanted people to understand what's happened here so they don't do it to themselves. And, you know, I even wrote it to be long term. So my ideal was that this will be remembered as some really insane part of our history, sort of like, you know, Britain in the 1970s. Just like, oh, the electricity was cutting off. There was, you know, IRA bombs. You know, it's much better than it was now. So, you can read it in the short term and sort of have it inform your electoral choices. But my hope long term is that this will just be a record of a time that was so crazy, we all try and pretend it never existed. And it's good to remember those things so we don't do them again in 100 years or so.
And Britain in the 1970s, they had Monty Python's Flying Circus and the Sex Pistols. Is there something in the pop culture of Canada right now which reflects Canadian values, reflects Canadian culture that we'll be looking at years from now?
You mentioned in the censorship chapter, just the fact that Jordan Peterson is just a very, conventional academic. 10 years ago, he was just you could call up the University of Toronto psych department. And if you needed someone to give a comment about what was his expertise, it was like, he was quoted in a story about like why Furbies are cute. So they'd be like, oh, the expert in this is Jordan Peterson. So he was just an academic. So the fact that Jordan Peterson went from that almost overnight into this guy selling out stadiums, this kind of messianic figure, is sort of indicative of that. He is a product of Canada in that we can take sort of a boring academic who sounds like Kermit the Frog and turn him into this like explosive rock star thought leader. I think that being a good example. So I think there's when you sort of take Canada and twist it this much politically. So like in this election right now, you actually have young people leaning towards the Conservatives at higher rates than older people. Now, there's been prior elections in which Conservatives captured the youth vote. Mulroney did that in the 1980s. But the fact that we have young people who are more conservative than old people, I haven't found another democracy where that's true, at least, you know, within living memory. You have a phenomenon in Canada in which everything is so topsy-turvy. We are yielding an outsized level of sort of YouTubers, commentators, comedians, etc., who are sort of can bring that message to the wider world. So, yeah, I think there is sort of a cultural upside. If you don't like Jordan Peterson, you could see that as a downside, but... I think he's a product of a country that's very much an outlier in terms of the global community.
Well, thanks again for joining me on the Breaker.News podcast. Tristan Hopper, columnist with the National Post, joining me from Victoria. Also the author of the new book, Don't Be Canada, How One Country Did Everything Wrong All at Once, published by Sutherland House.
Thank you so much.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In FocusTaiwan.tw, Taiwan will not retaliate against Trump's tariffs, says Lai. In a video address to the nation, President Lai acknowledged the significant impact that the 32% tariff would have on Taiwan's economy. He noted that although 23.4% of Taiwan's exports went to the U.S. in 2024, over 75% were shipped to other markets. Among the goods exported to the U.S., competitive ICT products and electronic components made up 65.4%, a sign that Taiwan's economy remains highly resilient. In Kyoto news, George Glass confirmed as U.S. ambassador to Japan. The U.S. Senate on Tuesday confirmed George Glass, a businessman from Oregon, with a background in investment banking and real estate, as ambassador to Japan. The chamber voted 66-32 in favor of Glass, a major Trump donor who has pledged to push Japan to expand market access for U.S. imports and increase defense spending. He served as ambassador to Portugal during Trump's first term as president between 2017 and 2021. In Hong Kong Free Press, daughter of ex-Hong Kong leader C.Y. Leung, Chai Yan, dies, aged 33. The ex-leader said that his daughter had died suddenly, but peacefully, in bed. A few days earlier, she took the initiative to get the flu vaccine, he added. The second of Leung's three daughters studied at German-Swiss International School before she enrolled at the London School of Economics to study law, but she left to pursue a career in entertainment. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, we've lost public trust. Sewer Board approves oversight after lavish spending revealed. The Oregonian reported that executives from Clean Water Services stayed in luxury resorts during annual business trips to Hawaii that cost tens of thousands of dollars, and that the agency spent $440,000 on local travel and meals over 5 years, which was four times more than its two metro area counterparts spent on food during that time combined. In the Washington State Standard, Washington AG takes software company to court over rental price fixing allegations. Attorney General Nick Brown said landlords have used RealPage to set rent for 800,000 leases across Washington. ProPublica reported on RealPage's algorithm and found just 10 property managers oversaw 70% of apartments in a Seattle neighborhood. All of them used RealPage's pricing software. The landlords named as defendants in the complaint are Graystar, Cushman & Wakefield, LiveCor, UDR, Prime Administration, Quarterra Multifamily Communities, LaSalle Properties, MG Properties, and Saris Regis Management Company. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. NDP-aligned One City hides candidates' jobs with Australian mining giant BHP. And exclusive, Whitecaps eyeing Hastings Racecourse for new stadium. Read the stories behind the headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer hate, so you won't stand alone, you won't stand alone.
The Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the people that take the calls around the clock to dispatch police, fire, or ambulance to where they are needed. It is Emergency Services, Dispatchers, and 911 Awareness Week in BC. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of April 13th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me.
Did you know that on the 13th of April in 1997, Tiger Woods became the youngest golfer to win the Masters at just 22 years of age? Now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to Bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. Sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow The Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support The Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.